Welcome to episode one of the Steptoe Cyber Law Podcast. It's lawyers talking about technology, security, privacy, and government. I am here with Michael Vadas, formerly of the FBI and the Justice Department, and now in Steptoe's New York office, and Jason Weinstein, formerly with the Justice Department, where he oversaw criminal computer crime prosecutions, among other things, now doing criminal and civil litigation at Steptoe. And I'm Stuart Baker, formerly with the National Security Agency, the Department of Homeland Security, and now doing whatever people will hire me to do in private practice. Why don't we just jump right in? We're going to cover the last couple of weeks of 2013 because there was a lot that happened. Maybe the most significant potential changes in national security law in the last 10 years were recommended by an expert working group put together at the request of President Obama. They came out with a long report with 45 recommendations. Michael, what's the takeaway from that report?
Well, there are a number of significant recommendations in the report, but I think it's interesting that a lot of the reporting on it has missed some wiggle room that I think is crucial in a lot of recommendations and will give the administration the ability to say it's adopting most of the recommendations, or at least many of them, while actually retaining the most significant aspects of the programs that have been so widely criticized. So let me go through some of the recommendations and explain what I'm talking about. At the outset, though, let me mention the five members of this expert review group. Richard Clark, who was a counterterrorism advisor in both the Clinton and George W. Bush administrations, and well before that, a government official.
And the guy who famously said, your government failed you at the 9/11 Commission hearing.
Right, exactly, and gained renown for that, although his own role or failings were not really part of that apology. Cass Sunstein, who is a law professor but also served in the White House and the Office of Management and Budget, as the key person responsible for approving all new regulations, and famously instituted cost-benefit analyses or requirement that agencies engage in that sort of analysis before issuing new regulations. Peter Swire, another law professor who was chief privacy officer in the White House during the Clinton administration. Jeffrey Stone, another law professor, the only one without government experience, at least that I know of, and Michael Morell, who was the deputy head of the CIA a few years ago.
So these guys were really insiders in most respects.
Other than Jeffrey Stone, yeah, I think this has also been widely missed, that all these people, despite some of them being known as civil libertarians to some extent, all had significant government experience, which you know, I think some people might fairly say predispose them to favoring the government's view. And so I think that, for that reason...
And other people would say made them more realistic about what can be done and can't be done.
Yeah, I try to state it in a more neutral way.
Oh, well, that's good for you. Feel free. The rest of us don't feel so obliged.
Right, but, you know, regardless of how you characterize it, I think... the fact remains that they did come out with some recommendations that would significantly change the way the government does intelligence if they were adopted in full. And so I think that their government experience notwithstanding, I think that is a significant fact. But still, as I mentioned, there is a lot of wiggle room on some of these recommendations, although not on others. The issue that has gotten the most attention is the government's metadata program, which is based on Section 215 of the USA Patriot Act, and that authorizes the government to obtain any tangible thing with a FISA court order, as long as that thing is relevant to an authorized national security investigation. And this has been the foundation for the government's program that allows the NSA to collect all of the so-called metadata of phone calls made from anyone in the United States. It could be from someone in the United States to someone overseas to someone in the United States, or purely internal calls within the United States. This has been roundly criticized as, you know, an abuse of this authority, as something that's unconstitutional, which we'll get to later in the broadcast, and a severe violation of people's privacy rights. And we can talk about whether any of these criticisms is valid later. But the group recommended significant changes in this. They called for an amendment to Section 215 that would require that the FISA court find that the government has reasonable grounds to believe that particular information is relevant to an investigation, and that the order is reasonable in focus, scope, and breadth. Now, you read that, and you might say, okay, that's a major change, because this would preclude the government from obtaining the metadata of every call made to or from the United States. And they also recommend that the government generally not be allowed to collect and store mass, undigested, non-public personal information about individuals. So that would, you know, I think when you read that on its face, it would require a major change in the way the government obtains phone records. Here's the wiggle room. The NSA makes the argument, and the administration as a whole have made the argument, that all of this information is necessary in order for the NSA to do the sort of analyses it needs to do to find when a terrorist is in contact with someone in the United States and possibly plotting a terrorist attack here. Because if it didn't have all this information, it couldn't analyze the connections, do the so-called chaining
Don't they solve that problem by saying you can only ask for it? I mean, the reason it's stored, all of it is gathered, is for that reason. They need to have all of it in order to do the searches. But if you store it with the telcos the way they are recommending, then the government only has to ask for it when they have a reasonable suspicion, which is actually the way the search program works now. So all they're really doing, if I understand it, is moving the location of the data from collected by NSA and stored by NSA to leave it with the telcos and then go to the telcos and do the searches on their systems rather than on a government system.
Right, and I think the main objection from NSA is that that would be more difficult, more time-consuming, because they would have to go to each provider individually once they realize that somebody who's in the chain that they're looking at is with a different provider from the first one, first person that they were looking at. And so it might add days to the process rather than seconds or minutes. And when you're dealing with an imminent threat, you know, that could be a deadly delay. That's the argument.
So this is not something that the president can do tomorrow whenever he gives his speech. At best, he can say, I'd be open to that if Congress wants to do it, right?
That's true if the telcos say, we're not going to store this stuff unless you require us to.
So actually he could start doing it right now and see how it works.
He could start doing it right now. And the other aspect here, which I think has been completely ignored, maybe because it's only in a footnote in the report, is that telcos have to store a lot of this data anyway for 18 months under FCC regulation. So, you know, it takes a little bit of the wind out of their objections to having to store this stuff, because the report recommends that they retain this information for 2 years. If they're already retaining all or most of it for 18 months, then we're talking about an incremental 6 months.
That's interesting. So it would be interesting if the president said, look, don't change anything about this program, but I'm going to try this idea that I got from my experts.
Yeah. I think that's right.
I was interested in something else that you had talked about, which was the recommendations for changing national security letters. And there was a hint in some of our discussions that maybe they don't really understand the law that they are were applying, because the national security letter recommendation comes from nowhere, right?
It comes from nowhere as far as I'm concerned. But let me, before I leave 215, let me just mention one thing, the wiggle room that I talked about, in, which would allow the president to say he's adopting most of the recommendation without making massive changes. As I mentioned, if you buy the NSA's argument about how vital it is to have the government store all this information, then you could satisfy this standard that says that the particular information is relevant and the scope is reasonable, because if it's necessary for the NSA to do its analysis, that it restore the data itself, then you could say that the scope of the order is reasonable. And also, you know, they recommend that the government itself not be allowed to collect and store mass amounts of public, non-public personal information. But they also say that's as long as that's without senior review, which means that if there's senior review and senior approval, the government can store mass amounts of undigested personal information. So, you know, these two things combined, you could have the president say, we're going to significantly change the program works, which will amount to saying we're going to have senior White House officials review and approve any collection and storage of mass amounts of data. So, you know, I'm not sure how this is going to turn out when the president's review is finished, but I think that's a possibility that he could take advantage of that wiggle room.
I think that makes sense. I went through that report myself looking for things I disagreed with, and I'm perfectly happy to disagree with most of these guys a lot. And I thought about a third of them were good ideas, a third of them were not great ideas, but not the end of the world. And a third of them were affirmatively bad ideas, but many, even the bad ideas, have those little escape clauses. Because these are guys who've been around the block a few times and know that it's not a good idea just to completely change everything without leaving yourself room to, you know, modify the position you're taking when it turns out not to be realistic.
Right.
So what about the NSL thing? And I'm going to ask Jason to give us his sense about whether it matches up with criminal law.
So NSLs are essentially national security subpoenas that allow the FBI on its own authority to send a letter to a telephone company and require it to turn over non-content information about phone calls or about electronic communications. There are other NSLs that apply to financial information of various sorts, but for our purposes, we'll talk about the internet and telephone, so-called metadata that the FBI can get with the National Security Letter. This has to be limited to a particular individual that the FBI has reason to believe is a spy or a terrorist. The report recommends that NSLs, be issued only with the approval of the FISA court. So this would make a major change. It would make it much longer, make it take much longer to get these sorts of information from the telcos and internet companies. And also, to me, it would render NSLs essentially superfluous, because the standard would be pretty similar to Section 215 orders, although limited to an individual. So if the government can go get a greater amount of information with the 215 order, why would it go to the same court, go through essentially the same process to get a more limited set of information? And I think the report just misses this outcome of what they're recommending.
So what about it, Jason? Does this mean that it's actually easier to conduct criminal investigations than to conduct national security investigations?
That's exactly what it means. I have to say, ever since the NSL was created, I've never understood the controversy over it, because all it did was essentially harmonize the authority of agents in national security cases to get data with the authority that law enforcement agents have in criminal cases. All you need to issue a grand jury subpoena, although it's called a grand jury subpoena and it's issued under the broad authority of the grand jury, it's really issued at the discretion of the prosecutor. And all you need for a federal prosecutor to issue a subpoena is a printer and a subpoena form.
And a ham sandwich.
Well, that's to indict. But you don't need a ham sandwich to issue the subpoena. You just need the printer, the form, and the computer. And agents in criminal cases have the authority to issue what are called administrative subpoenas, which are subpoenas issued under their authority as law enforcement agents that are, as a practical matter, done with the concurrence of a prosecutor, but they don't require the authority of the grand jury, the prosecutor, or anyone else except the agency. So the effect of this, if this recommendation is adopted, is that it will be easier for a criminal investigator, a federal agent in a bank fraud case or a drug trafficking case or even a significant, such a significant case as a theft of the mail at Christmas time, to issue subpoenas to get data of this type than it will be in a terrorism case where there is an imminent threat to national security.
Well, this just means the Justice Department is going to run all of our anti-terrorism operations because they'll be able to get subpoenas and nobody else will.
Well, it'll be a boon to criminal, to prosecutors in national security cases, but they'll be hard to investigate in the first place.
Okay, so I want to move on, but one last question. Single worst idea in this report. I'll give you mine, and you guys can tell me what you think is the least attractive idea. There's a provision here that says when we're doing foreign intelligence focusing on foreigners, we shouldn't focus on foreigners because of their political and religious views. That just strikes me as political correctness run amok. The idea that we shouldn't be interested in leaders of religious factions who may turn against the United States and we want to know what they're thinking, that's why you gather intelligence. And half the world or more divides itself on religious and political grounds, and we shouldn't be saying, oh, well, we can't use that as a reason for gathering intelligence. Michael, your thoughts?
My vote would go to the recommendation that the NSA not exploit so-called zero-day vulnerabilities to collect information. Zero-day vulnerabilities are those that have not been discovered and publicly discussed yet. And so essentially they'd say NSA can only use those exploits that hackers already know about. Talk about tying the hands behind the backs of our intelligence community. You know, NSA, the whole business of NSA is to break into computers and telecommunications networks abroad to gain information of foreign intelligence value and to prevent attacks against the United States. And if we're telling them they can't be any more sophisticated than hackers, we are really shutting down their ability to do their job effectively. Now, here, too, there is wiggle room, and so you've got to hope, if you care about national security, you've got to hope that the administration takes advantage of this wiggle room. And the wiggle room is this, that they say NSA should not exploit zero-day vulnerabilities except in rare instances and only for high-priority collection. I guess I hope that they define, if the government does adopt this recommendation in some form, that they not define high-priority collection too narrowly and they not really limited to very rare circumstances.
Well, every prosecutor is going to think they've got a high priority investigation. Jason?
Well, Michael's was mine, so I'll take a different one, which is I've never been a big fan of the idea of requiring there to be a public advocate at the FISA court. When a criminal prosecutor in a criminal case gets a search warrant or gets another kind of court order, it's done ex parte and there's no adversary process. There's no defense lawyer representing the community at large, challenging the prosecutor's assertions to the court to get a search warrant. The system of checks and balances works not because there's an adversary there when the order is issued, but because there's accountability after the fact about the way the order has been executed. And so the ultimate ability of the checks and balances system that the FISA court is supposed to represent to function will be holding the agency and the people who represent the agency before the court accountable for misrepresentations, if they're done purposefully and intentionally, and for providing incorrect information to the court if it's done intentionally, not having some generic public advocate there to challenge the assertions at the front end.
So let's talk about how actual advocates arguing about the constitutionality of these classified programs have done. We had the remarkable opportunity to see two different district court judges address the 215 program, and they came to opposite conclusions. Michael, what's going on here, and who's more persuasive?
Let's see. We got these two decisions that are only 11 days apart. The first one held that the 215 program is unconstitutional. That was the case of Klayman v. Obama, decided by Judge Richard Leon in the Federal District Court in Washington, D.C. And the theory of the decision is basically that the so-called third-party doctrine doesn't make sense in today's age for this type of information. The third-party doctrine stems from a case called U.S. v. Miller, in which the government was using a pen register to intercept the numbers that were dialed by a person who was the subject of an investigation. And the Supreme Court ruled there that the person has no reasonable expectation of privacy in those phone numbers that he was dialing because that information was shared with a third party, i.e. the telecommunications company that he was using. And so that doctrine has been applied since that decision back in 1979, I believe, in lots of different contexts. It applies to bank records. Courts have applied it to various sorts of communication information and any other data that's stored with a third party. And Judge Leon said, you know, this doesn't make sense when you're dealing with the types of information that we are talking about here. He said, you know, in fact, the situation here is so different that he found Miller to be completely irrelevant. And he said, you know, what a pen register is a limited amount of information over a limited time focused on one person. Here you've got all the numbers that a person has ever called or been called by that are obtained and stored indefinitely by the government. And in his view, this allows the government to get a view of the most intimate aspects of a person's life. And he drew support for this notion from the Supreme Court's decision in U.S. v. Jones, which involved the placement of a GPS tracking device on a person's car and allowed the government to trace that person's movements over an extended period of time. Now, the Supreme Court decided that case on a limited trespass theory. That is, they found a Fourth Amendment violation because the government trespassed on the person's property, i.e. the car, without a warrant. But five justices said, you know, that's really not the, or four justices at least said, that's not really the way to look at this case. We really should be looking at whether this intruded on a person's reasonable expectation of privacy, trespass or not.
So Michael, my sense on this was an act of judicial insubordination. He said, this is a Supreme Court opinion that case that has not been overruled, has not been directly questioned, but I'm not going to follow it because things have changed. And, you know, you do that if you're a halfway intelligent judge only when you think that the Supreme Court will back you up. And the Jones case does suggest that there's at least a possibility. I mean, how many justices said we don't like this? All of them, right? And so...
My point I'm trying to make is you got five justices, you have four in the Alito concurrence and Justice Sotomayor. Justice Sotomayor specifically said it may be time to reevaluate the third-party doctrine in today's age when you're talking about Internet information in particular, I think. And the Alito opinion basically says that even though a person's movements are visible to the public, that doesn't mean that a person has no reasonable expectation of privacy when you're talking about a lot of information over an extended period of time. So I think it's fair to say that given you've got those five justices' views, the Supreme Court in this case might come out where Judge Leon did. You know, you could say that's not the district court's role in our judicial system, but it happens all the time. Lower courts trying to predict how the Supreme Court is going to deal with an issue that it has not dealt with before.
You know, interestingly, in the heels of the second opinion, you know, as Michael said, they were 11 days apart. About a week after that, the FISA court reissued its authorization for the program, becoming like the 16th.
That's right. If you're keeping score at home, this is now 16-1 in favor of the program.
Right.
But 15 of the 16 are in the FISA court, and many of their opinions haven't been declassified. It's clearly dividing the courts. What's the future for this? Didn't the Justice Department appeal one of these already?
Well, I think that Judge Leon stayed his order to give the Justice Department an opportunity to appeal. I don't know if the appeal's actually been filed yet.
I think it has been.
So one of the things that Justice Alito observed in his Jones opinion is that is that the kind of line drawing that we're talking about here, balancing privacy and public safety, and especially when you're talking about the context of evolving technology, that those, Justice Alito observed, those lines are better drawn by Congress and the courts. And I think that the way the law is starting to develop and these splits are starting to develop in the courts illustrates why that's true. You know, the government needs, whether you're talking about national security cases or criminal cases, the government needs clear lines, or lines that are as clear as possible, to tell them what they can or cannot do, and to have, you know, basic governmental functions be the subject of wildly disputed opinions, and especially if it takes years to resolve this at a higher level, it's going to compromise national security operations, and it may bleed over into law enforcement too. I mean, with due respect to Judge Leon, I think Judge Pauly in the New York case had it right when he said that the volume of data collected or the efficiency with which it's collected is irrelevant if there's no reasonable expectation of privacy in the data in the first place. And Judge Leon seems to think that, in trying to distinguish the Miller case and the sister case, Smith versus Maryland, he seems to suggest that the volume of data that can be collected so quickly and the prevalence of cell phone use in America and the cool things you can do on cell phones now.
Well, as he said, it's replaced lighters at rock concerts. So obviously we have a renewed privacy interest in it. That was the wackiest line.
Yeah, I didn't even know you could use them as a lighter at a concert. I learned that in the opinion. But the fact that cell phones have taken over a large part of our public and private lives, and that the data can be collected efficiently and in large volumes is irrelevant if there's no privacy interest in that data in the first place. And I think that Judge Pauly did, in my view, a more persuasive analysis of the fact that there is no privacy interest in that data. The fact is the records you're talking about are records that belong to the phone company. They don't belong to you. The phone company collects them, generates them, maintains them so that it can provide you with a service. And they are classic third-party records. The fact that there are many of them and that the phone company is in a position to collect a lot of them and that there's a lot more data generated by your phone than by the landline when these cases were decided in the 70s, doesn't change the fundamental fact that these are records that are collected and created and maintained by the phone company. They belong to the phone company, and you can't have a phone service without providing this information. So I thought the New York case was more persuasive, but I think the fact that the cases 11 days apart came to such wildly different conclusions calls out for a congressional resolution of the.
Then there might be. Michael?
It's worth pointing out that Judge Pauly, who found the program constitutional, is a Clinton appointee, while Judge Leon, who struck down the program, is a George W. Bush appointee.
Yeah, but hating this program is a project of the right now more than the left. So it's not as surprising as you might think.
Well, I wouldn't say the whole right. You know, I think the libertarian fringe of the right, but certainly you got members of Congress who are conservative Republicans supporting the program still.
Okay, so I'm gonna try. We need to wrap this up. I'm gonna ask you guys for two predictions on these the litigation. One, what are the courts of appeals going to do with it, and is the Supreme Court going to take this one of these cases? Michael, I'll start with you.
I think that the courts of appeals, you know, it depends on the panels, of course, but I think they're likely to say that the program is constitutional, at least until the Supreme Court explicitly overrules or limits the third-party doctrine. And I think the Supreme Court will take the case if it hasn't been mooted by a change in Section 215 from Congress, or unless it's mooted by changes that are unilaterally made by the Obama administration to basically get rid of the aspects that Judge Leon found made it unconstitutional.
Jason?
I agree with that 100%.
All right. I disagree with that. I don't think the Supreme Court is taking this case if the SG, the Solicitor General, opposes certiorari. If the Justice Department says don't take this case, they've got 100 good reasons not to take this case, including the fact that in June of 2015, the program may cease to exist or will have to be tweaked or otherwise modified. And so they'll have to make a decision on whether to grant cert, I suspect, before then, with the prospect that they could be wasting their time because of the decisions that will come along. That strikes me as a great reason not to take the case.
you think they wouldn't take it even if one or both courts of appeals strike down the program?
Yeah, well, that if then the Justice Department will be on the side of granting certiorari, and if the Justice Department wants the Supreme Court to review this, they will, and if they want them not to review it, they won't. That's my prediction. All right, thank you guys. This has been a great discussion, and that wraps up the first episode one of the SEPTO Cyber Law Podcast with Michael Vadas, Jason Weinstein, and Stuart Baker.